Eleanor Coppola is maybe a name that isn't instantly recognizable, but her husband Francis is one of the most celebrated American directors of his generation, and her children Sophia and Roman have also received critical acclaim as filmmakers. Sophia, of course, at the moment has The Beguiled out in cinemas. So what made Eleanor at 80 decide to make her first narrative feature? In a moment, you'll hear her discuss her debut, Paris Can Wait, with me, Jason DeRosso. Hi, this is The Final Cut on RN, the weekly film show. Also today, an interview from the archives with horror master George Romero, who died this week. But first, the film of the week, Dunkirk.
The call went out.
We have to go to Dunkirk.
Ready on the stern line.
What are you doing? You know where we're going.
Into war, George.
They need to send more ships.
Every hour, the enemy pushes closer.
They've activated the civilian boats.
Civilians? We need destroyers.
The enemy tanks have stopped.
Why?
Why waste precious tanks when they can pick us off from the air like fish in a barrel?
Writer-director Christopher Nolan's powerful, immersive 10th film brings the evacuation of Allied troops at Dunkirk into sharp relief. Skipping between several plot lines and temporal shifts, its cast includes Kenneth Branagh as the Admiral coordinating the British Navy's chaotic evacuation from the Dunkirk mole, Tom Hardy as a Spitfire pilot chasing down Stuka dive bombers in the sky above, and Mark Rylance as an aging seafarer who joins the civilian flotilla of small boats which came to bolster the rescue mission. Up to 400,000 Allied troops were left stranded on the beach in the spring of 1940 after massive defeats at the hands of the advancing Germans. Of these, Nolan's film focuses initially on one young man running from a flurry of bullets through the deserted streets of the town at the beginning of the film. It's a frightening, thrilling opening, but the thing that strikes you is the sound. Nolan likes the confrontational energy of high-volume effects, and the sound of the bullets whooshing and spitting leaps out of the sound mix. The rest of the film proceeds with a similar intensity. Its musical score operating at ear-blistering level, with a string section that wails and then stabs, and horns that groan like some kind of doomsday accordion. Nolan's audacious, if at times annoying, placement of the soundtrack so high in the audio mix is something he did in his last film, Interstellar. And on one level, it helps illustrate the feeling of being overwhelmed. At certain points, the musical noise engulfs everything, even the dialogue. But in so doing, it glues the narrative fragments of the film into an adrenaline-charged mosaic of destruction and desperation. The sense of claustrophobia is reflected in visual ideas throughout the film. One of several climactic moments sees Nolan cut between a pilot who has ditched into the sea, struggling to open his glass hatch as water fills the cockpit, and a group of soldiers, including a splendidly nasty Harry Styles, escaping from the hull of a sinking boat. Again and again, Dunkirk feels like a depiction of suffocation, and underscoring this is its deliberately British perspective on events. The Germans are never seen. There are no cutaways to enemy pilots, for example. And even the French appear mostly on the fringes. At one point, a group of them tries to join their British comrades in the chaotic throng on the Dunkirk mole, only to be met by an officer who barks, "Only British." It's one of several troubling moments that keeps a sense of jingoism at bay in this film. That said, while Nolan's film seems like a dark, uncompromising slab of wartime mayhem, at times you can see it's related to more mainstream Hollywood sensibilities, like the broody younger brother of a Spielberg movie. Take the moment when Kenneth Branagh's face expresses a brief flash of relief as he sees a Spitfire chasing down a Stuka dive bomber. Or worse still, when he cracks a hint of a smile when he finally sees the civilian flotilla on the horizon. I guess I'm saying these moments are a little clumsy, but that would be overstating it. There is, however, an emotive deficit in many of Dunkirk's thinly drawn characters, which causes the film to stumble on certain turning points. It's a pity because Christopher Nolan has an undeniable talent for cinematic shorthand. A moment on a beach between two soldiers hurriedly burying a comrade in a shallow grave is one of the film's finest. And the image of a pair of boys absent-mindedly throwing pebbles glimpsed through a train carriage window is an effortlessly poetic counterpoint to the destruction elsewhere. It's also to Nolan's credit that the film's most tragic death, the one that leaves you shell-shocked after the end credits, is nestled among the intersecting plot lines in a moment when you least expect it. His exciting set pieces of sinking ships and aerial dogfights will thrill audiences who head to big Hollywood films for spectacle. But when Nolan gets the subtler moments right, you really do see something much more. Dunkirk is out now. Check your guides for cinemas showing the film in 70mm celluloid.
What has happened is a colossal military disaster. We shall go on to the end. We shall never surrender.
On RN, you're listening to The Final Cut with me, Jason DeRosso. There is a genre of romantic film, or even relationship movie, where the landscape is just as important as the couple in it. In Roberto Rossellini's Voyage to Italy, an English couple's simmering marriage crisis is brought to the boil against sun-bleached landscapes and ancient ruins in southern Italy. Sometimes these kinds of films take the subject of a holiday romance as their focus, something Richard Linklater did in the Before trilogy, placing the emphasis on the frisson of meeting someone from a different culture and the possibilities of renewal and rebirth, maybe, that can offer. This week, a deceptively breezy film, a debut feature from Eleanor Coppola, the documentary maker, author and artist who's married to Francis and is the mother to Sophia and Roman, treads the same path. It's inspired by a real-life experience that Eleanor had in 2009 when a bad ear infection meant she couldn't accompany her husband on a flight from the Cannes Film Festival and ended up travelling to Paris in a car with one of Francis Ford Coppola's French colleagues instead. The trip took a couple of days and many detours, it turned out, because the Frenchman was fond of good food and wine and wanted to show her the best of his country. Perhaps, too, if we're to believe this big screen adaptation of the event, he wanted to seduce her. In this case, the most seductive thing you can do for a woman seems to be simply to listen to her. Paris Can Wait, which stars Diane Lane and Arnaud Viard, Alec Baldwin, by the way, plays the mostly absent husband, portrays all of this with good humour. Coppola was 80 when she made it, and her alter ego, Diane Lane's character, displays a patience born of wisdom. Her character realises she's being flirted with, but she's happy to linger on the should I or shouldn't I and endure the unreliable mechanics of the vintage Peugeot that her companion drives. He, in turn, is both playfully flirtatious and genuinely kind.
Michael called me just before we came down for dinner. He's worried about us here together. Are you?
Should I be?
Well, I don't know. In a long marriage, after your child leaves home. Are you happy?
Oh. We have a good marriage?
No, it's not what I asked you. Are you happy?
Along the journey, a series of wonders opens up for her, from ancient Roman ruins to the marvels of French food. There are some shots in this film that made me audibly sigh. Lane and Viard work well together on screen. Their understated performances, aided by a light script, inspire us to imagine their lives outside of the frame. Without overstating it, this is a modest film in many ways. I think there's a palpable sense of joy in Paris Can Wait, as well as an acknowledgement of life's sorrow and disappointment. It's a film that intuitively senses the power of travel as a trigger of personal transformation. I caught up with Eleanor Coppola on the phone from her home in the Napa Valley and asked if it was harder or easier to make a narrative feature debut at 80.
Probably a little bit of both, you know. Obviously, I didn't have quite the same stamina as my crew. I mean, at the end of the day, I had to go to my room and have a yogurt and go to bed, and I could hear my crew downstairs hooping it up at the bar. But I also think there's an incredible freedom when you're older. To me, it wasn't so important if the film was a disaster, you know, nobody would care. If it was success, it was not going to start my career. You know, I felt like it was just a great opportunity to do something I'd never done before that was really hard and just a great wake up in life to have this opportunity, although it took 6 years, you know, to get it together, to make it happen. But every obstacle I met, I just kind of kept going. So it was a good learning process for me too.
I imagine, obviously, you have a family full of filmmakers. Was there one of them in particular that was sort of the most supportive? I mean, Francis, Sophia, Roman, I mean, who did you lean on the most, if you leaned on any of them?
Well, I sort of felt I had to go on my own. First, I had to get over my personal fears. I've never written a script, and I'm living with, you know, two Academy Award-winning screenwriters and things like that. I just kind of had to just step over all that and just go my own way. Francis in the beginning wasn't so encouraging because he thought I'd never really get it together, and he didn't want me to have my heart broken, you know, that I could doubt I would ever be able to make the money, raise the money, because of course I have no sex, I have no violence, I have no aliens, I have no car crashes, I don't have anything a banker wants to put money in. So it looked like it was probably never going to happen from his perspective, I think. And my kids, you know, they were very involved in their own productions, and so I mean, they wished me well, but I mean, they just really want me to be mom. You know, when you come home, you don't want to talk about mom's film. You want mom to make, you know, to make lunch and be a mom. So I was pretty separate but not estranged from my family. I was just trying to get it going, and they were nice about it, but they weren't the people that I counted on to help me.
Well, it's interesting because the film does speak about how women put their own passions on hold, especially for their husbands' careers. And clearly this is a semi-autobiographical film in many ways. Do you think that women today have it easier than women of your generation when it comes to sort of realizing their own professional ambitions?
Oh, very much so. I see the difference between my daughter's generation and mine, of course. So obviously, you know, I married a very traditional Italian who thought the woman's position was to support her husband's career and take care of the children and make a nice home. And my own creative life was like always kind of an annoyance or an intruder or something that didn't fit well with the family life that my Italian husband envisioned. So I was always at a little bit of odds, but we also didn't have any real understanding at that time of what the issues were. But my daughter is completely on a different stage. She made her first film when she was 27, I think. And, you know, her husband at the time, he was making films, and it was totally understood that that was going to be her work and her life. And there was no question about whether or not she was just going to stay home with the kids. And she has balanced it very well. She has a wonderful husband and two beautiful children, and she's learned how to do it. She has to have really good child care. And in my day and age, if you didn't take care of your kids, there was something wrong with you. What's the matter? You can't take care of your kids, lady. Anyway, it's a different generation. I'm so proud of the movement that women have made from the stigma of being in a profession and now being able to be in a profession.
I'm wondering, I mean, I don't want to get too overly personal with you because it's not really that kind of show. This is a show about cinema, but given that this film is highly sort of autobiographical and does deal with this subject matter. I mean, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what kept you in the marriage, given that perhaps if you had contemplated life outside family life, traditional family life, you would have been able to sort of realize certain sort of creative ambitions.
Well, my husband and I are often asked, what's the secret to our long marriage? We've been together for 54 years. And the answer is, don't get divorced. You know, you meet life. And obviously, my life was very interesting to me and very exciting. We traveled to all these locations. You know, there were many, many positive aspects to it. So, I mean, I think there's no life that's completely perfect. And I feel like I had a very abundant share of the upside, too.
Yeah. Tell me, with regards to this film, it seems to be in the tradition of a kind of very classic type of romantic film that deals with landscape in a very interesting way. And the influence of the landscape on the couple at the centre of the film. And I'm thinking of things like Rossellini's Voyage to Italy, but also more recently the Linklater films, the Before Sunrise, the Before trilogy. Can you tell me about the films that it influenced you? Were they amongst the influences?
Yeah, no, I think Before Sunrise, but the films that I really liked are like the films of Jane Campion, and I'm very conscious of the visual look of the film. I'm a trained artist, and so it was very important to me who the cinematographer was and the look of the film. And if the food looked beautiful, if the landscape looked beautiful, that the visual part of it was, you know, an element, a character in the movie, not just kind of some background or something.
Has Francis seen the film, and what does he think about it as a sort of reflection on your marriage or a particular point in your marriage?
Yes, he's seen the film, and he's been, although I was in France by myself, I would call him and he would give me his experience, wisdom, and was extremely helpful. And I think we both realize that my trip was one thing and the movie is something else. I mean, there are elements that I draw from my own experience, but also I wanted to tell a story about a woman who was 50, who her child had just left home, and that transition period of her husband isn't really understanding of her period of her life, that transition of how to help her. And she goes on this road trip, but the French guy is not perfect either. I mean, it's not like he could just run off into the sunset with a Frenchman. And she really comes to the realization at the end of the film that her life and her next step in her life is her responsibility, is up to her, and there's joyful freedom in the fact that she has choices, but they're her choices, you know. So that's more the story I wanted to tell, not really an autobiography.
Eleanor Coppola, her film Paris Can Wait is a gem for romantics and Francophiles alike.
They're after us. They know we're still in here.
They're after the place. They don't know why. They just remember that they want to be in here.
What the hell are they?
They're us, that's all. There's no more room in hell.
What?
Something my granddaddy used to tell us. You know Makumbo? Voodoo. Granddad was a priest in Trinidad. He used to tell us, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
This week, pioneer horror filmmaker George Romero died, age 77. The Cuban-Lithuanian-American, who grew up in the Bronx, debuted with his first feature in 1968, a zombie film called Night of the Living Dead, shot in black and white on a shoestring with a group of friends. It was powerful cinema, but also a striking metaphor for the race riots and civil disturbances that were then tearing America apart. Indeed, most of Romero's Dead series, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Land of the Dead, and Diary of the Dead, can be read as statements about American social ills, racism, consumerism, militarism, corporate greed. I met him when he was in town for the Melbourne International Film Festival back in 2008, and I thought I'd replay the interview. It begins with the question, does the idea of a political metaphor come first with a Romero film?
No, usually the idea does come first, or some observation of what seems to be going on out there. When I made the first film, Night of the Living Dead, I didn't have those kind of expectations, and I think all the political stuff that is in it some of it was accidental. I mean, Dwayne Jones, who plays the lead role, is an African-American. He happened to be the best actor from among our friends. Film was finished before Martin Luther King was shot. The posse came through and shot that character in the head when on the page he was still a white guy. So we really can't take credit for that. Then all of a sudden, after the film was out in the United States and had disappeared, drive-ins, neighborhood theaters, it was gone. Actually returned some money, and we said, easy business, started to work on another film, and we're actually working on the third when all of a sudden a magazine in France, Cahiers du Cinéma, was the first to write about Night of the Living Dead, calling it essential American cinema. And it panicked me. And I said, yikes, I mean, what am I? I really resisted wanting to do another one. I said, boy, I've got to really step up to the plate if I'm ever going to tackle this again. And then socially, I knew the people who developed this big shopping mall in Pennsylvania, the first big indoor shopping temple to consumerism. And I went out to visit before it was even open. That was the moment. I said, here's a nice idea. And instead of the farmhouse, I'll have some people hole up in this mall, and I'll have some fun talking about consumerism and all this. And that's when it came to me. I said, you know, I could do this every once in a while. I could, if I see something out there that I want to talk about or express my opinion about, I can bring the zombies out of the closet and glue them on.
Who to you are the zombies? And has your idea changed with the films as you've developed them?
They don't represent anything. I mean, I've read analyses of these, you know, everything from in the beginning, they were the silent majority, you know, and none of that. To me, they could be Hurricane Katrina. They're just the disaster. And the stories are more about how people deal with that disaster or fail to deal with it or deal with it stupidly.
When the zombies reappear, is it usually because George Romero is particularly angry at something in the world?
Oh, angry? Angry or just finding it silly. I mean, that shopping mall, I just said, this is the ultimate. I didn't think that it could go much further than that. And of course, it always does. There's always that little bit of disappointment, too. You keep thinking, well, you know, the Bush administration, this will certainly bring them down. No, next year there's another big thing that is certain to bring them down, and somehow it doesn't happen. So you just sort of keep plodding ahead.
I want to move on to talk about some of your other films now, films that are showing in this retrospective in Melbourne. One I was particularly taken with was your film Martin, about a young troubled guy who may or may not be a vampire. You've said it's your favorite film.
It is, yeah.
Why is that?
You know, I don't know that it's the best film. It's so hard to look at them that way. It's sort of like, which is your favorite kid? So much goes into that. Your favorite kid may not necessarily be the best behaved, but that's sort of the way it is, I find, with my films.
But Martin in particular, I found it worked as a metaphor, I think, for a certain sort of migrant experience and that tension between the generations in a migrant family, between the generation that looks still to the old country and the generation that kind of has to deal with living in the new country and living with the weight, I guess, of all that past and all those traditions. Does it reflect your own experience?
Not necessarily my own, but my dad's probably more, and my grandfather on my mother's side. You know, just talking to those guys and, you know, realizing what they had to go through and the generational changes and the acceptance of things. Like my grandfather could never accept sort of that New York way of life. You know, he really was clinging to the old country ways, everything from the food to the just the behavior. And he couldn't ever get with this, you know, this sort of more liberal free thinking. And I always found conflict between that. And I just thought, well, this is a neat way, you know, if I use this vampire idea, the old guy is believes that it runs, that there's something in the family blood, you know, and so he's just trying to push that on the kid. Did that cause the kid to be troubled? I don't know. But in my mind, he's not. You have to make a pick when you're doing a movie like that. And my pick was he's not. he enjoys the taste of blood, but he's not a vampire in the supernatural sense. He's just sort of twisted young guy who's very honest about it. He calls into this radio show and talks about it very openly. But of course, you know, the old world way is to just drive a stake through that guy's heart. So it's a bit like, you know, what happened to autistic people 50 years ago.
George Romero speaking to me in 2008. He died this week. You've been listening to The Final Cut. I'm Jason DeRosso. See you next week.